Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Who were the Anunnaki? Giant hominoids, standing on average 8 foot tall and far heavier and more muscular than humans. Visiting Earth from their home planet, termed the Planet of the Crossing by the ancient Sumerians. This planet is known by many names: Nibiru, Marduk, Wormwood, the Destroyer, the Red Star, and lately, Planet X. But the ancient Sumerians termed it the 12th planet, as they counted the sun and Earth's moon also. In the words of the Zetas, and I quote, "There is life on the 12th planet, the giant comet that causes periodic pole shifts. The primary race is a hominoid race, who would be and have been considered giants by humans on Earth. There have been many excellent books written on this subject, and all hold a grain of truth. They have a hierarchical structure. We would venture to say no true democracies, as you might term them. However, there are among them intellectuals who have great compassion for their fellow creatures and fellow citizens and have great influence in their society and are revered. The giant hominoids of the 12th planet to this day dress in attire reminiscent of Roman soldiers. Rome, in fact, modeled after them, rather than these hominoids modeling after the Romans. The males find this to be a comfortable attire that has a macho image. You might look to your ancient Greek and ancient Roman societies for a glimpse of their lifestyle, because these societies carried the influence of these visitors very heavily. The giant hominoids were not grossly muscular, as mankind's overdeveloped muscle men are. They were, and are, well-proportioned, with rounded muscles but without the extreme bulging that musclemen try to achieve. Nancy, who has met one, will tell you that they are extremely attractive and proportional. The giant hominoids had long faces, but the skulls that have been discovered and ascribed to aliens are not these giant hominoid skulls. The Easter Island heads were designed to intimidate, as this appearance in the face was and is indeed their facial structure. They do not sleep because they do not have a rising and setting sun. They have a dimmer day. The glow in their atmosphere comes from rifts within their ocean. They are inhabiting a brown dwarf that is in a slow smolder. It happens also to be a water planet, so that the places where the results of the chemical reaction that produces their light come through are in the deepest rifts closest to the molten core and scattered throughout their atmosphere. Therefore, they have a continuous light, equivalent perhaps to late in your day or very early in the morning. They do have their quiet times. Their agriculture is much less extensive than the agriculture of Earth. They tend to gather rather than grow. There are fewer of them per square mile than your rich and fertile Earth sustains. Gold mining is occurring today on a moon of Mars, which has been approached by man's probes and subsequently shot down by these hominoids, who were not about to let themselves be filmed by their former slaves. This moon, Phobos, is rich in the mineral they seek, that being gold. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, 12th Planet, written July 15, 1995. Zachariah Sitchin, author of several books documenting what the ancient Sumerians had to say about these giant hominoids, puts his finger on a key confirmation that they were indeed visitors from a planet entering our solar system. The evidence? They counted the planets from the outer edges of the solar system inward. And I quote from Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, chapter Landing on Planet Earth. In February 1971, the United States launched Pioneer 10. Pioneer 10 scientists attached to it an engraved aluminum plaque. It attempts to tell whoever might find the plaque that mankind is male and female, etc., and that Pioneer 10 is from the third planet of this sun. Our astronomy is geared to the notion that Earth is the third planet, which indeed it is if one begins the count from the center of our system, the sun. But to someone nearing our solar system from the outside, the first planet to be encountered would be Pluto, the second Neptune, the third Uranus, the fourth Saturn, the fifth Jupiter, the sixth Mars, and Earth would be seventh. We know today that beyond the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn lie more major planets, Uranus and Neptune, and a small planet, Pluto. But such knowledge is quite recent. Uranus was discovered through the use of improved telescopes in 1781. Neptune was pinpointed by astronomers guided by mathematical calculations in 1846. It became evident that Neptune was being subjected to unknown gravitational pull, and in 1930, Pluto was located. End of the quote from Sitchin's book. Sitchin reports that their planet, today known as Planet X, only crossed our solar system every 3,600 years, the ancient Sumerian Shar. And I again quote briefly from Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet, chapter Kingship of Heaven. The 12th planet's periodic appearance and disappearance from Earth's view confirms the assumption of its permanence in solar orbit. In this, it acts like many comets. If so, why are our astronomers not aware of the existence of this planet? The fact is that even in orbit half as long as the lower figure for the comet Kohoutek, which comes through every 7,500 years, would take the 12th planet about six times further away from us than Pluto, a distance at which such a planet would not be visible from Earth. In fact, the known planets beyond Saturn were first discovered not visually, but mathematically. The Mesopotamian and biblical sources present strong evidence that the orbital period of the 12th planet is 3,600 years. The number 3,600 was written in Sumerian as a large circle. The epitaph for the planet, Shar, also meant a perfect circle or a completed cycle. It also meant the number 3,600. The identity of the three terms, planet, orbit, 3,600, could not be a mere coincidence. The reign periods a Sumerian text gives are also perfect multiples of the 3,600-year Shar. The conclusion that suggests itself is that these Shars of rulership were related to the orbital period Shar, 3,600 years. End of the quote from Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet. In fact, the Zetas report that Planet X, also known as the 12th planet, spends most of its time located more than nine Sun-Pluto distances from us, halfway between our Sun and our Sun's binary, a dark twin never seen because this binary has never lit. In fact, the Zetas say this binary is 18.74 Sun-Pluto distances from our Sun, far more than the six Sun-Pluto distances that Sitchin states would be the minimum for a planet to be visible. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Distance from Earth, written November 15, 1999. The 12th planet is circling on a long sling orbit around the Sun and its dead companion, which lies at a distance some 18.724 times the length from Sun to Pluto. At the turn of the millennium, the 12th planet was still close to the midpoint between the two foci, as astonishing as this may seem. It spends the vast majority of its time in an essential dither between these two massive suns, picking up speed as it approaches, inbound, then zooming through, turning around after coming to a standstill after having overshot the solar system, then shooting through again and returning to the essential dither point between its two foci. What makes it move and progress from one sun to the next? the fact that there is a slight momentum. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Distance from Earth. This confirms what Sitchin states about a planet more than 6 Sun-Pluto distances away not being visible to man on Earth. And this is why NASA and JPL had to use an infrared cloud above the atmosphere to locate it in 1983. And I quote from a front page article, December 31st, 1983, Washington Post. A heavenly body, possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of the solar system, has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. infrared astronomical satellite. So mysterious is the object that astronomers do not know if it is a planet. So close, in fact, that it would be the nearest heavenly body to Earth beyond the outermost planet Pluto. End of the quote from the Washington Post. The Anunnaki giants, left behind to mine for gold, built astronomical devices to help their progeny know when the home planet would be coming back to collect the gold. Thus, the giant pyramids. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Giant Pyramids, written July 15, 1995. Humans ponder the pyramids of Egypt and some similar structures in South and Central America and wonder how early man could rise or move such large stones. Of course, they could not. Even today, the mechanics would be imposing to the point of being impossible. The answer is, of course, that early man did not build these structures. The giant pyramids were built essentially as navigational devices. Why was it necessary to build such large structures as interstellar navigational guides? Because in the locale, any astronomical device would be subject to shifting sands. The great pyramids, by their great size and weight, ensure stability. All this just to sight an incoming comet, which makes its appearance on a regular basis and can be seen weeks, if not months, beforehand? The giant pyramids were not used solely for sighting an incoming object, as their primary purpose was to act as a guidance system for the launches the exiled 12th planet residents would make to meet their home planet. This required precision, as their rockets were no more sophisticated than those used to boost man into space today. And once in space, they simply coasted until dawn into the gravitational orbit of the water planet they owed their allegiance to. They did not last on Earth from one appearance of the 12th planet to the next. Several generations would pass. The knowledge of how to read the stars and what the 12th planet kingship expected of them passed from parent to child. Conscientious parents, aging and sure to die before their progeny could return to the home planet, where they had royalty status, built a navigational system that was rock sure and solid, the giant pyramids. Could the pyramids act as guides for the forthcoming reappearance of the giant comet, the 12th planet? Many pole shifts have occurred since they were built, each time the crust of the Earth sliding into new positions. Legends has it that the giant pyramids originally pointed near the Orion star system, and those legends have carried true to their origin. Where this is the original point convergence, the spot where the giant comet first looms into view, the giant pyramids no longer act as a guide in this manner. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Giant Pyramids. There is a rumor that the giant pyramids pointed directly north and south. I've seen this on the internet, and I did a web search for facts to substantiate this rumor and could find none. What I did find was a document that stated the pyramids were more or less north-south aligned, which is far from being precisely aligned north-south. And this tends to substantiate what the Zeta said about the giant pyramids no longer aligning to point toward Orion, etc. But the giant pyramids do hold clues that they were astronomical devices. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Secret Chamber, written November 15, 1995. All types of rumors abound about the great pyramids, some true, some false. It is known that a hidden chamber exists, accessible only by a tunnel so narrow that it might be traveled by a rat, yet so straight and long that it could only have been used for sighting. The room has no other entry and was never intended to hold a solid object. A liquid pooled in the shallow basin and reflecting light outward only when light shone down the long tunnel at that particular angle, the light from the approaching 12th planet. Various other sighting tunnels, as yet undiscovered, caught the reflected light. The liquid, of course, evaporated over time, leaving only the puzzle behind. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Secret Chamber. The Sphinx was also built by the hands of the Anunnaki. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Sphinx, written July 15, 1995. The Sphinx is an example of a fancy burial chamber, a mausoleum of sorts, built by visitors from the 12th planet who were into the sport of lion hunting. The grave was intended for a large and powerful male who stood tall in the circle of hunters, and all felt having his grave guarded by one of their conquests a suitable statement on his abilities and might. As is often the case in the affairs of man, these plans went awry as he was slaughtered by a rival and went unburied altogether, his body rotting under the sun, eaten by lions, no doubt. End of the quote from Sphinx. Being giants compared to man, and technologically as advanced as mankind is today, primitive man considered the Anunnaki to be gods. As the iron suits worn by knights during the Middle Ages show, man did not have the stature in the older days that he does today. They were short, perhaps 5 foot tall. This may be due to nutrition, as it seems to have changed only recently. There's a log cabin near where I live today that has a doorway only about 5 foot tall, very narrow. Can't imagine the big hulking men that live in our village getting through that doorway. Thus, for primitive man, an 8 foot tall Anunnaki would indeed be a giant. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Ancient Gods, written July 15, 1997. It is not by accident that the hominoid inhabitants of the 12th planet look and dress like Greek gods, the gods of Mount Olympus, as they are one and the same. Mythological stories about thunderbolts being thrown and travel through the clouds were based on the technological feats of these visitors from the 12th planet, who had mastered the modern-day equivalent of lasers and transporting an individual via rocket boosters strapped on the back. To the primitive humans who came barely to the waists of these strapping, handsome giants, they were gods. The Greek gods are reported to be jealous and wrathful on the one hand, and kindly and mentoring on the other, a bit like people. Of course, they were no gods, any more than the humans of today, but their very human exploits are still reported with awe. The legends among many human cultures regarding the exploits of the giant hominoids from the 12th planet are in no small part due to the rigid rules these visitors had regarding interbreeding with the humans they used as virtual slaves. Kept apart from humans in this manner, they retained their edge, as they were by far the largest, the most technologically advanced, and the smartest hominoid race around. Humans were, at the time, evolving from the caveman stage, with only an occasional genius born in the purely human strains. During the evolution of any species, intelligence is gradually increased due to genetic selection, the smarter individuals passing on their genetics due to their ability to evade danger and manipulate circumstances around them. Thus, the discrepancies between humans and the visitors from the 12th planet were many and significant. The stories generated by these tall, stately giants are almost endless in human mythology, but can be recognized and differentiated from stories based on mere humans by several distinctive traits. 1. The gods were hominoid in appearance. Mere humans are not raised to the stature of gods by other humans, in spite of cultures which temporarily and in a patronizing manner call a reigning human king or chief a god. 2. The hominoids were savage and exacting in their treatment of their human slaves, executing them for trivial infractions as examples, and unforgiving no matter how trivial the affront or fervent the apologies. 3. They had technology that seemed miraculous for the age, such as the ability to throw what appeared to be lightning bolts, or float along above the ground, or take off in rocket ships, or perform surgery and have the patient live. 4. They lived apart from humans, in separate quarters or villages, yet visited their human slaves frequently enough that the slaves considered themselves unable to escape, in bondage without physical bonds. Ancient Egyptian gods, ancient Babylonian gods, the Visigoths of Germany, ancient Mayan and Incan gods, are almost to a one a particular individual from the 12th planet royalty, stationed on Earth to supervise mining operations. Stories about ancient rebels, noted for their stature and courage in battle, are also frequently based in part on the heritage from these visitors, as the rebel most often carried some genetics from the rape of a female slave, who managed somehow to escape and bear her oversized infant alive. The legacy today is genetically dispersed throughout the Mideastern countries, Germanic countries, and the South Seas, and is identifiable in those hominoids who simultaneously possess a large stature, a fierce temper, and strong musculature. Rather than being considered gods, they are often considered criminals. End of the quote from Ancient Gods, written July 15, 1997. David, of the David and Goliath tale, was such a half-breed, and thus was not a mere man challenging one of these giants. And I quote from Zeta Talk, King David, written on July 15, 1997. Like many humans who bore genes originating from the giant hominoids from the 12th planet, King David was greatly admired for his strength and courage. That he took on one of these giants in the historical David and Goliath battle is not surprising, as he had a personal hatred of their domination, learned at his mother's knee. Female slaves, who were held in bondage to act as more than cooks and maids, became pregnant on occasion by the brutish and fiercely strong soldiers working in service to the mining outpost the 12th planet rulers routinely put into place during every periodic passage of the 12th planet through the solar system. Chosen for their unhesitating brutality in the line of duty, these soldiers were used to keeping their human slaves that worked in the mines in line and seldom displayed any tenderness, not even to their lovers. Most often, a female slave that had been impregnated would die in childbirth, unable to deliver an oversized infant, taking her infant with her. On rare occasions, half-breeds survived, often without their mothers who bled to death or were torn beyond repair. David's mother, like he, bore the genes from a half-breed and thus had the hips to bear the product of rape and live. Beyond the great strength and unflinching courage, which are traits of the giant hominoids from the 12th planet, they have a singleness of purpose when roused into anger. Thus, he became a leader of the downtrodden and was held in great esteem, this reverence expressed in devotion to his symbol, the Star of David. His lineage, the House of David, was noted primarily for its courageous leadership. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, King David. The fierce Visigoths of Germany were another example of the stamp these giants had on the cultures they visited. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Visigoths, written April 15, 1996. Were the giant hominoids from the 12th planet the inspiration for the Viking gods or tales of the Germanic Visigoths? The Viking gods and Visigoths were fierce and did not back away once the conflict had begun. What were these giant hominoids doing in Northern Europe, exploring in the same manner that took them to South America and thence across the Pacific? They were looking for gold and went prospecting everywhere. End of the quote. Giants. Could these be the Nephilim of the Bible who fell to earth from heaven? Precision, one and the same. And I quote from an interview with Sitchin, an introduction by Electronic Magazine. Sitchin, who were the Nephilim that are mentioned in Genesis chapter 6 as the sons of gods who married the daughters of man in the days before the great flood, the deluge. The word Nephilim is commonly, or used to be, translated giants. And I am sure that you and your readers are familiar with quotes and Sunday preachings, etc., that those were the days when giants were upon the earth. I questioned this interpretation as a child at school, and I was reprimanded for it because the teacher said, "You don't question the Bible." But I did not question the Bible. I questioned an interpretation that seemed inaccurate, because the word Nephilim, the name by which these extraordinary beings, the sons of gods, were known, means literally those who have come down to earth from the heavens. Interviewer, from the Hebrew word Nephal, which means fall. Sitchin, right, fall, come down, descend. So what did it mean? This led me to biblical studies and then to mythology and archaeology and all the other subjects, including the study of ancient languages, which became my education and avocation. So my research and my decision to write about it started with a question. Who were the Nephilim? All the ancient scriptures, the Bible, the Greek myths, the Egyptian myth and text, the pyramid text, everything led to the Sumerians, whose civilization was the first known 6,000 years ago. I focused on Sumer, the source of these legends and myths and texts and information. I learned to read the cuneiform Sumerian texts and came upon their persistent and repeated statements that these beings, whom the Sumerians called Anunnaki, came to earth from a planet called Nibiru. The planet was designated by the sign of the cross, and Nibiru meant planet of crossing. End of a quote from this interview with Sitchin. Where many myths about the Anunnaki have a basis in fact, many others do not. Many were based on swagger and bragging, or simply a misunderstanding of their written or spoken word. Not much different from our own human cultures, it seems. For instance, they had a normal lifespan and did not have a fountain of youth. I quote from Zeta Talk, Long Life, written February 15, 2002. The issue of the Anunnaki living for thousands of years is a misunderstanding. When placed on Earth for a mining operation, they expected as a culture and as a royalty family line to live that long until the next passage. Poetry misunderstood. The visitors from the 12th planet carried with them on their long sojourns to Earth a plant with medicinal qualities native to the 12th planet. They grew this in special gardens, shielded from the intensity of the sun. This plant could renew their cellular structure, a type of growth hormone stimulant. They took this stimulant in the form of a bath, soaked in this plant. Reputed to rejuvenate, it gave rise to the legend of the Fountain of Youth, but this is much exaggerated. In fact, it merely slowed a degenerative disease the transplanted hominoids suffered while on Earth. End of the quote. For instance, they did not genetically engineer man, though tinkering with genetic engineering, as mankind is doing today. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Birth of Man, written February 15, 2002. As the largest and strongest hominoid on Earth at the time, the giant hominoids from the 12th planet were understandably arrogant about the effects their genetics had on the humans they bred with. There were two lines of hominoids left to run the mining operations between passages of the 12th planet, royalty and soldiers. The royalty interbred with each other, retaining the purity of their genetics, as without this purity, their line would be forced to die out upon return to their home planet. The soldiers had lower class women from the 12th planet available to them as sexual consorts, but often chose to create and maintain harems of human sex slaves of all ages and from both sexes. Most often, the offspring died during childbirth due to the large size of the infants, but those who lived carried genetics from the father, which gave rise to the legend that these hominoids created the human race, which is simply not true. The giant hominoids from the 12th planet did not genetically engineer humans. They toyed with genetics, and thus the rumor has started. These giant hominoids were experimenting with genetics, just as humans are now eagerly embracing such activity as they were slightly ahead of humans on the evolutionary scale. Thus, when they toyed with the idea of what genetics could bring, they doodled with the possibility merging animal and human species, and this was taken literally by the people who discovered these doodles. Humans doodle, making pictures of eagles with lightning bolts in their talons. Does this mean that future generations would find these drawings and take them literally? These were representations of a fascination with the possibility of what genetic manipulation could create. Mankind was created not by these hominoids, but by others who did the genetic engineering, and this erroneous myth should be put to rest. End of the quote from Zetatonk, Birth of Man. As slave masters, the Anunnaki used cruelty to control their slaves. This is also of legend. Beating hearts torn out of chests and displayed to the face of those still living victims. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Mayan and Incan, written August 15, 1995. High in the mountains of South America stand traces of ancient civilizations with similarities to the ancient Egyptian civilization. Structures built with large blocks of stone, closely trimmed and fitted in much the same manner as the Great Pyramids. Space forts on high mountain plateaus, which can be seen clearly from space but scarcely discerned while on the ground. In the steamy jungles further north lie the outline of cities abandoned for no known reason. The land is fertile, the water supply ample, yet they lie unattended and uninhabited. Legend has it that human sacrifices were performed atop pyramids, like platforms, hearts ripped from the chests of the living, yet no trace of these practices exist among the local peoples. Human sacrifices were never an indigenous practice, as this grim method of punishment was only used by the dominant visitors to keep their restive human slaves in line. End of the quote. Destroying a city as revenge for a single gang rape is another example. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Sodom and Gomorrah, written October 15, 1995. Prior to recorded history, there were many dramas that earned their place in history by their impact. They so impressed those who lived through them that the story was repeated endlessly until the era of recorded history arrived. As these dramas occurred before clocks and calendars were in use, no one is sure of the date, but the circumstances, often told in allegory fashion, generally arrived intact. Such is the case with the tale of Sodom and Gomorrah, the city of sin destroyed, so the story goes, by the hand of God. This story has a basis in fact. Sodom and Gomorrah were two rather smallish cities in the arid lands of the Middle East. In those days, sodomy was a common practice among males without a mate. Young boys sent out to mind the herds learned from older boys how to use the sheep and goats they tended to relieve sexual tension. From that, it was a short step to using each other when in the cities, and no one thought much of it, a favor among friends. Such was the situation in Sodom and Gomorrah, during the era when visitors from the 12th planet walked the earth. These visitors are strapping, handsome hominoids who themselves chose their sexual partners as they saw fit and were in no way subservient to the puny humans they generally considered their servants and slaves. In Sodom and Gomorrah, the practice of sodomy was accompanied by domination games and had gotten rowdy, with several toughs thinking they had no match. A single 12th planet hominoid traveling with his entourage was raped near these cities by a gang that wouldn't take no for an answer, and the repercussions were brutal. The visitors from the 12th planet had the bomb and used it. Business partners were warned ahead of time, but were given scarcely enough time to leave. No time for goodbyes, or even a lingering last look. Yet the wife of one business associate did just that. She lingered, not wanting to leave the home she loved, and not truly understanding the circumstances. When the bomb exploded, she was gazing down on the city and was in the line of the blast rather than over the hill, and was essentially vaporized where she stood. Legend explained her burned and hardened remains, gray with the fine dust of the fallout, as a pillar of salt. End of the quote from Sodom and Gomorrah. The Anunnaki also used intimidating headgear, as recently featured in the movie Stargate. And I quote from Zeta Talk Dogon Tribe, written August 15, 1995. Much has been written about the Dogon Tribe and their knowledge about the stars. Such a simple people kept out of the industrial age even today. How did they come by this information? Their visitors hailed from the 12th planet, who even then had advanced knowledge of the stars as they plotted their travels by them, so as to know their place out in space, just as ancient mariners held to the stars to know what place they occupied on the vast oceans. The dog heads worn by the masks of these visitors were a common ploy, occasionally switched for the heads of birds or snakes. While under the influence of those in the service to self-orientation, they found these masks aided them in terrifying the diminutive humans they encountered, as their expressions could not be read. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The Anunnaki needed gold for their home planet to retain the heat and light that bounced up into the atmosphere. Their home planet, Planet X, also known as the 12th planet, is a smoldering brown dwarf, neither a planet nor a sun. With a slow enough smolder that heat and light are generated, but not to the extent that life is not possible. It's a life-bearing water planet that generates its own heat and light. And I quote from Zeta Talk, the 12th planet glow, written July 15, 1995. The 12th planet has both heat and light generated from within its core. Life on the 12th planet, which is inhabited by a large hominoid indistinguishable from humans other than by its size, experiences continuous day. Life that has evolved there does not sleep, but rests. The light is diffused in the atmosphere and returns to the land surface, but emerges from the core to interact with the atmosphere only via the surface of the deep oceans, which cover the majority of the planet's surface. You may equate this to volcanic activity, where the Earth has numerous places both above ground and under the oceans that ooze molten lava. Just so, the 12th planet has places where the molten and churning substance in its core escapes to the surface. On the 12th planet, the heat released diffuses in all directions, so the surface of the planet is warm but not hot. Your feet would not blister, but they may feel cool in places where the rock strata do not provide a good passage for heat, should you visit that planet. Light only escapes the core where what is essentially volcanic activity under the water occurs. End of the quote from Zeta Talk 12th Planet Glow. Their search for gold and the value they placed on it is the reason humans today place such a high value upon gold, and it gave rise to many legends. And I quote from Zeta Talk, El Dorado, written October 15, 1995. The obsession with gold is not natural to man. It's a habit mankind picked up from the visitors from the 12th planet. What about gold makes it so cherished? Platinum is as tarnish-free, silver and copper as malleable, and yet gold is accepted as a metal more precious than others, more desirable, a metal to die for. This attitude toward gold, passed as a heritage from generation to generation, was impressed on mankind from those who had to have gold and did not hesitate to kill for it. Where mankind uses gold for adornment or as a medium of exchange, the visitors from the 12th planet were collecting gold for survival. Their home planet, on its long orbit out in space, is subjected to atmosphere abrasion the Earth and her other planets on more sedate orbits around the sun do not suffer. The 12th planet loses atmosphere here and there on a regular basis, and where this can be rebuilt from its copious oceans, being basically a water planet, certain elements become depleted. Molecules in the atmosphere containing gold are necessary to retain the heat and light the planet generates, to keep the heat and light, essentially, bouncing back to the surface, as without these gold-based molecules, the planet dims and cools. Thus, the visitors from the 12th planet came to Earth on a search, a mining mission, and were intent on raping the Earth of its relatively abundant gold and using its primitive hominoids, humans, as slaves to do so. It was impressed upon mankind early that gold was the ruler's due, and death fell to he who hoarded or withheld it. El Dorado, the lost city of gold, was a staging point where the spaceships used as shuttles were loaded and sent aloft at the appropriate time. Since this time only arrived once every 3,657 years, on average, a lot of gold stacked up. Long after the visitors from the 12th planet left the Earth, the humans who had heard the stories from those who made deliveries to El Dorado searched for this city of gold. They search still. However, the ruins, when discovered as they have repeatedly been discovered, are not recognized, as there is no gold. Why would these visitors, so desperate for what was essentially a life-giving metal, leave any behind? End of the quote from Zeta Talk, El Dorado. Were the Anunnaki on Mars? They certainly were in the past, mining for gold there, as they eventually did on Earth, and leaving evidence of their presence as they have on Earth. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Structures on Mars, written July 15, 1995. There are remnants of an ancient civilization on Mars that at one time also colonized Earth. Those who pursue this matter academically are not off track, recognizing the similarities between these structures and those of ancient Egypt. It is not in the imagination of man that some of the structures on Earth, such as the giant pyramids and the Sphinx, seem reminiscent of structures on Mars. Same group, same handiwork. They liked to leave a statement, and have. There is speculation that the face on Mars and nearby pyramids were used as astronomical markers, and this was indeed their prime purpose. They wanted an unmistakable marker that could be seen on approach, as the surface of Mars has few distinguishing characteristics. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Images taken by the many probes NASA has sent to Mars confirm this, documenting the face on Mars and grid-like city streets and aqueduct outlines, though NASA worked energetically to suppress this information. And I quote from an Associated Press article dated May 23, 2000. NASA makes 20,000 images of Mars available on the Internet. NASA has made more than 20,000 images of Mars available as a web-based photo album. The pictures taken by an orbiting Mars global surveyor constitute the single largest one-time release of images for any planet in the history of solar system exploration. The archive covers one Mars year, 687 Earth days, beginning in September 1997 and extending through August 1999. The release allows anyone with Internet access to explore Mars in much the same way planetary researchers do. Mars Global Surveyor completed more than 5,000 orbits of the Red Planet. End of the quote. Ah, but how many of those 20,000 images were of the contested face on Mars or other suspected man-made landmarks? Despite intense pressure on NASA to film the area, everything but the Cydonia region was imaged. And I quote from the Daily Mail, London, August 17, 1996. Best-selling author Graham Hancock, whose book Fingerprints of the Gods was the publishing phenomenon of 1995, believes there is evidence to support the theory that monumental structures on Mars that have mystified scientists for 20 years are the remains of a great civilization. These structures, detected in NASA video images sent back by the Viking orbiter in 1976, have never been photographed since, but have become the focus of a widening controversy over the past 20 years, because they include several enormous pyramids and a massive sphinx-like base. Carl Sagan urged that forthcoming American and Russian missions to Mars should make a special effort to look much more closely at the pyramids and what some people call the face and the city. End of the quote from the Daily Mail. The late Carl Sagan's voice was joined in this matter by the late Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who also encouraged close inspection. And I quote from the Toledo Blade, January 8, 1998. The mysterious face on Mars is not an optical illusion or natural feature on the red planet. Dr. Tom Van Flandern reached this conclusion after new studies of the Cydonia region. His report, presented at the 191st National Meeting of the American Astronomical Society, AAS, attracted unusual attention because sharp new images of the face may soon become available. End of the quote. Well, unfortunately, sharp new images did not become available. NASA withheld them. What were the Anunnaki doing on Mars? Mining for gold. They washed the ore with surface water, sending it into underground caverns during this process, destroying the atmosphere in the process. Thus, the traces of former life on Mars and former lakes on Mars found today. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Life on Mars, written July 15, 1995. Mars today is a dead planet, but in the recent past this was not the case, as evidenced by the weathered structures on Mars reminiscent of the giant pyramids and the Sphinx. Some life-bearing planets have a stronger footing than others, being closer to the warmth of a sun, for instance, and more particularly being a water planet like the Earth. Mars has little of that precious substance and was a life-bearing planet only where the freezing point had not trapped the water. The atmosphere surrounding a water planet can rebuild quickly, particularly in the components that support life. On a dry planet, the atmosphere is fragile, and each rebuilding takes away more of the precious water. In the past, Mars sustained life to a level not unlike our home in Zeta Reticuli. Moss and insects and worms. On such worlds, there is not enough food in the food chain to support animals above that level, and setbacks occur repeatedly. A bug-eating reptile might get its start, only to die off during lean times, time and again. Thus, such planets plateau. Mars met its demise as a result of visitors from the 12th planet, who set up mining operations on Mars in preference to Earth, where large carnivorous mammals roamed about in great numbers. The 12th planet has no such carnivores on land, and as large and muscular as these giant hominoid visitors are, they quaked at the thought. Where the atmosphere on Mars was thin, it was ample, so the visitors set about using what water resources they could muster to wash the ore they were after. In doing so, they sought to control the runoff on the relatively flat surface of Mars, and did so in a thoughtless manner by directing wastewater down the culvert. Thus, precious water increasingly was sent underground, and a chain of events was set in motion that could not be reversed. The surface of Mars cooled as the atmosphere thinned, and the freezing surface accelerated this process. Soon the atmosphere was too thin to breathe, and as the 12th planet hominoids are used to a perpetual summer, they were not all that reluctant to leave a freezing planet. Earth now looked more promising, especially as they had little alternative. They devised ways of dealing with the carnivores, specifically buffering themselves with human slaves trained in defense. Eventually, after being quarantined from Earth, they learned how to create and maintain their own atmosphere in airtight chambers, and thus, relocatable, they have continued their mining operations within the solar system, on this spot or that, and are here still. End of the quote from Life on Mars. Well, from what I see, they first went to Mars, and after they destroyed life there, they came to Earth, and after things got hairy there, they went to a moon of Mars, Phobos, to mine for gold. And the Zetas are indeed speaking of the Mars moon Phobos here, heavily endowed with gold ore, which the Anunnaki have been mining and living within up to the present. They've been mining the moon of Phobos from the inside out. NASA's jet propulsion labs had to admit the evidence of water on Mars. And I quote from JPL, June 29, 1998. Several clues from Pathfinder data point to a wet and warm early history on Mars. The bulk of the landing site appears to have been deposited by large volumes of water, and the hills on the horizon known as the Twin Peaks appear to be streamlined islands shaped by water. End of the quote from JPL. Unmistakable water on the surface of Mars, but where had it gone? Unwilling to admit that hominoid hands had been at work diverting the water, it remained a mystery. While on Earth, the Anunnaki also used the moon as a staging point and as a communication assist. And I quote from ZetaTalk Moon Cities, written December 15, 1995. Despite NASA denials, all the structures on the moon are not natural, nor are they man-made. The moon, so close to Earth yet clear of the Earth's congested surface and atmosphere, has been used by many alien groups and for many reasons. Currently, it's a home for those in the service to self who reside there. However, their home is not what humans are talking about, as they are placed on what is called the dark side of the moon, never visible from Earth. During the era when the hominoid visitors from the 12th planet were running mining operations on the Earth, primarily for gold, they used the moon as a communication outpost, as it was free of dust cover and allowed for a more precise aim through space. The moon was thus a booster, magnifying signals sent from Earth and sending a clear, strong signal into space. These communications went into their mining operations on Mars, but primarily to their home planet when it drew near, as the opportunity for contact with home was not to be missed. The shards of communication crystals, abandoned and idle, but causing quite a stir among humans these days. End of the quote from ZetaTalk. Yes, they used crystals for communication. And I quote from ZetaTalk, Tetrahedral Crystals, written July 15, 1995. It is not your imagination that you see tetrahedral shapes on the moon and the faint outline of such on the eroded surfaces of Mars. Yes, they are there, and yes, they had a purpose in the past. They are not inactive structures with no reuse in the foreseeable future. What were they used for? And is there magic in the shape? The shape is significant, as it is functional. Large crystals have been used to boost communications in Earth's past. The tetrahedral form simply provides the best focused emission when energy was applied on all perimeter surfaces and converged in the center. This was one of the things noticed by the astonished astronauts when they disembarked on the moon. This subject receives much press and much speculation, as the rumors can be supported by faint images in amateur telescopes. End of the quote from ZetaTalk, Tetrahedral Crystals. The Ark of the Covenant was in fact such a communication device, thus the voice of God seeming to emerge from the Ark. And I quote from ZetaTalk, Ark of the Covenant, written July 15, 1995. The Ark of the Covenant was a device used for communication by members of the 12th planet. They found the element gold to be useful in many ways and treated it in a worshipful manner by elevating gold to the status of a god, the god of communication. Crystals have also been used by this race as communication boosters. Because of the awe and reverence surrounding the Ark, primitive humans perceived the Ark to be a touchstone of the gods, especially when the voice of what they assumed to be a god came booming forth. Hominoids from the 12th planet would go inside the covenant, voices would emerge, and then they would leave, having gotten their instructions. Surely this was from God Almighty. The Ark itself was treated as a sacred object, as it was valued and lives were sacrificed if it was mistreated in any way. Like most objects that are poorly understood but seem magical, the Ark of the Covenant gained a reputation that superseded its true worth. The Ark was eventually broken down and its gold reused by the folks who built it and understood that it was not all that sacred. Humans, poor misguided souls, are still looking for this lost Ark and may look forever. End of the quote from ZetaTalk. There are many internet rumors that the Anunnaki will return to Earth as conquerors. Hardly. They're in quarantine, and any such attempts will not succeed. Likewise, we here on Earth are quarantined from them, and thus the failure of so many Mars probes, and the failure of attempts to nuke Planet X, their home planet, to divert it from its path. And I quote from Zeta Talk Conquest, written February 15, 2002. They cannot shuttle to Earth at this time, as it has been deemed by the Council of Worlds to constitute interference with your free will, because their interaction with humans sprang from their agenda for conquest. The quarantine was put into place some thousands of years ago, but close enough in your recent past that contact remains in your legends. They have no plans, despite fear-mongering among those claiming to be in contact with these folks, to return to Earth, which they consider a swamp. The Earth in their memory is full of carnivores, rebelling slaves, and accidents related to wild weather. Now that mankind has technology, a fact that cannot be denied due to probes sent about and requiring their mining operations on Mars to shoot them down when they came too close, they are even less inclined to visit. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The Anunnaki were given blows in the past, too, to reduce their influence on Earth. Case in point, Atlantis. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Lemuria and Atlantis, written June 15, 1997. Atlantis was land near the current continent of Europe, which was pulled into the Atlantic during the continental rip that accompanied violent pole shifts and thus disappeared dramatically under the sea. This demise was assisted by extraterrestrials, who took advantage of the natural cataclysm to adjust the balance in spiritual orientation, influencing developing human spirits, in line with the determination by the Council of Worlds that such an adjustment was needed. Atlantis had been essentially invaded by the giant hominoids from the 12th planet, who prior to the quarantine that is now in effect were considered simply another hominoid race within your solar system. Interactions between humans and these hominoids were allowed to proceed without interference, but increasingly slavery of humans by these giant hominoids was tipping the balance so that humans were less and less free to choose their orientation based on their true feelings, and increasingly influenced by feelings of helplessness. Thus, an adjustment was required. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. So, quarantined, making the passage on their home planet, past the Earth during its pole shift, what will the Anunnaki experience during this passage? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Roller Coaster Ride, written April 15, 1997. Since the passage of Planet X is so devastating to the Earth, what must the ride be like for the giant hominoids who live on the surface of the 12th planet? During the passage, the hominoids are using history as a guide, as those who last experienced the passage are long dead. This history is recorded as astronomical terms, so sighting the solar system and confirming the orbits of the planets is reassuring to those who might be nervous about the coming passage. In fact, the passage is viewed not unlike a holiday, where great dramas are played out before the eyes of the rapt audience. When passing the Earth, they can visually see the pole shift as it occurs, a phenomenon which draws rapt crowds, just as an eclipse of the sun by the moon does on Earth. Lightning storms occur in their upper atmosphere during the passage, fireworks rarely seen on their calm world. Thus, the passage is more a holiday than a dreaded situation. However, those with empathy for the human population of Earth grieve, but there is scarcely anything they can do about what is occurring on the Earth. They can no more steer their planet than mankind can. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought. Those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.